Chapter 31. The roar of the engines lessened as the unmarked Beechcraft jet lifted away from Buckley Field outside Denver and rose toward its cruising altitude. The snow-capped Rockies fell away behind as the aircraft set its nose across the Great Plains. "The President sends his best wishes for a speedy recovery," said Dale Nichols. "He was quite angered when briefed on your ordeal."
"Madder than hell is a better description," Schiller cut in.
"Let's say he wasn't happy," Nichols continued. "He asked me to express his apologies for not providing stronger security measures, and promised he will do everything within his power to ensure your safety while you remain in the United States."
"Tell him I'm grateful," Haller replied, "and please beg him for me to give every consideration to the families of the men who died saving my life."
"They'll be well taken care of," Nichols assured her.
Haller was lying propped in a bed, wearing a white velour sweatsuit, striped in jade, with a knit polo collar. Her right ankle was in a plaster cast. She looked at Nichols, then toward Julia Schiller and Senator Pitt, who were all seated opposite her bed.
"I'm honored that three such distinguished gentlemen took time from their busy schedules to fly to Colorado and accompany me back to New York."
"If we can do anything?"
"You've done much more than any foreigner on your soil could expect."
"You have the lives of a cat," said Senator Pitt. Her lips parted in a slight smile.
"I owe two of them to your son. He has a capacity for appearing in the right place when you least expect him."
"I saw Dirk's old car. It's a miracle you all survived."
"A truly beautiful machine," Haller sighed. "A pity it was destroyed."
Nichols cleared his throat.
If we may touch on the subject of your address to the UN tomorrow.
"Have your people turned up any solid data leading to the Alexandria Library artifacts?" Haller asked sharply.
Nichols glanced at the senator and Schiller with the look of a man who suddenly stepped in quicksand. The senator threw him a rope and gave the reply.
"We haven't had time to launch a massive search," he said honestly. "We know little more than we did 4 days ago."
Nichols began hesitantly.
"The president, he hoped..."
"I'll save you time, Mr. Nichols."
Haller's eyes turned to Schiller.
"You may rest easy, Julius. My speech will include a brief report on the imminent discovery of the Alexandria Library antiquities."
"I'm glad to hear you've changed your mind."
"Considering recent events, I owe your government that much."
Nichols was visibly relieved.
"Your announcement will give President Hassan a sharp political advantage over Ahmad Yazid, and a golden opportunity to boost Egyptian nationalism over religious fundamentalism."
"Don't expect too much," said the senator. "We're only filling cracks on a crumbling fort."
Schiller's lips parted in a cold smile.
"I'd give a month's salary to see Yazid's face when he realizes he's been had."
"I'm afraid he'll really come after Haller with a vengeance," said the senator.
"I don't think so," said Nichols. "If the FBI can link a chain from the dead terrorists to Yazid and then to the assassin responsible for the plane crash with the death of 60 people, many moderate Egyptians who do not condone terrorism will withdraw their support from his movement. With an internationally publicized terrorist mission laid on his doorstep, he'd have to think twice before ordering another attempt on Ms. Camille's life."
"Mr. Nichols is correct on one point," said Haller. "Most Egyptians are Sunni Muslims who do not follow the bloody revolutionary drumbeat of the Iranian Shiites. They prefer an evolutionary approach that slowly changes the people's loyalty from a democratic government to a religious leadership. They will not accept Yazid's bloodlust methods."
Haller paused a moment.
"I disagree on the second point. Yazid won't rest until I'm dead. He is too fanatical to give up. He's probably planning another attempt on my life this minute."
"She may be right. We must keep a sharp intelligence eye on Yazid," cautioned the senator.
"What are your plans after your UN address?" asked Schiller.
"This morning, before we left the hospital, I was given a letter from President Hassan by an attaché from our embassy in Washington. President Hassan wishes me to meet with him."
"Once you leave our boundaries, we can't guarantee your protection," Nichols warned her.
"I understand," she replied. "But there is little cause for concern. Since President Sadat's assassination, Egyptian security people have become quite efficient."
"May I ask where this meeting will be held?" queried Schiller. "Or is it none of my business?"
"No secret. In fact, it will be covered by the world news media," Haller answered nonchalantly. "President Hassan and I will confer during the coming economic meetings in Punta del Este, Uruguay."
The mangled and bullet-holed cord sat forlornly in the middle of the shop floor, as Benson slowly circled the car and shook his head sadly. "This is the first time I've ever had to restore a classic car 2 days after I finished it." "We had a bad day," Giordino explained. He was wearing a neck brace, one arm was in a sling, and his nicked ear was heavily bandaged. "It's a wonder any of you are standing here." Except for 6 stitches, mostly hidden by his hair, Pitt was unmarked. He patted the buckled chrome radiator shell as if the car was an injured pet. "Lucky for us, they used to build them to last," he said quietly. Lily limped painfully from the shop office. Her left cheek was bruised and the opposite eye was blackened. "I have Hiram Yeager on the phone," she announced. Pitt nodded. He put a hand on S. Benson's shoulder. "Make her even better than she was before." "We're looking at 6 months and heavy bucks," said S. Benson. "Time is no problem, and neither is money." Pitt paused and broke into a grin. "The government is going to foot the bill this time around." He turned, walked into the office, and picked up the phone. "Hiram, you got something for me?"
"Just a status report," Yeager replied from Washington. "I've eliminated the Baltic Sea and the coast of Norway."
"And nothing showed?"
"Nothing worth celebrating. No matching of geologic contours or geographic descriptions from the Serapis log. The barbarians Rufinus mentioned don't come close to fitting the early Vikings. He wrote of people who resembled Scythians, but with darker skins."
"That bothered me, too," Pitt agreed. "The Scythians came from Central Asia. Not damned likely they'd have been fair-skinned and blonde."
"I see no sense in continuing the computer search around Norway into the northern waters of Russia."
"I agree. What about Iceland? The Vikings didn't settle there for another 500 years. Maybe Rufinus meant Eskimos."
"No go," said Yeager. "I checked. Eskimos never migrated to Iceland."
"Rufinus also threw in the mystery of the great sea of dwarf-like pines. He couldn't have found them on Iceland. And don't forget, you're talking about a 600-mile voyage across some of the worst seas in the world. Historical marine records are quite precise. Roman ship captains rarely sailed out of sight of land for more than 2 days. The voyage from the nearest European landmass would have taken a 4th-century ship 4.5 days under ideal conditions."
"So, where do we go from here?"
"I'll run the West African coast by again. We might have missed something. Dark-skinned Africans and a warmer climate seem more logical than the cold northern countries, especially to men from the Mediterranean."
"You still have to explain how the Serapis came to be in Greenland."
"A projection of wind and currents could give us a clue."
"I'm flying back to Washington tonight," said Pitt. "I'll look in on you tomorrow."
"Maybe I'll have something," said Yeager, but his tone did not sound optimistic.
Pitt hung up and stepped from the office. Lily looked at him with an expression of hope. Then she read the disappointment in his eyes.
"No good news?" she asked.
He shrugged negatively. "Seems we haven't left square one."
She took his arm.
"Yeager will come through," she said encouragingly.
"He can't work miracles."
Giordino held up a watch on his good arm.
"We don't have much time to make our flight. We better get rolling."
Pitt walked over, shook S. Benson's hand, and smiled.
"Make her well again. She saved our lives."
S. Benson looked at him.
"Only if you promise me you'll keep her away from flying bullets and ski slopes."
"Done."
After they left for the airport, S. Benson opened a rear door of the cord. The door handle came off in his hand.
"God," he said mournfully, "what a mess."